Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's September 1st, 2019, and welcome to episode 199 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and what, upgrades? I don't know. Whatever. Happy September. I am Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I am joined today by Carrington Vanston in Toronto.
I am indeed in Toronto.
Oh, and how are you, I should say?
I am indeed well. Except my voice sounds like I'm not. Yeah. So my voice is doing poorly, but the rest of me, looking good.
Excellent. All right. And also joining us is Jack Nutting in Stockholm. How are you?
Hello, Paul. I'm doing pretty well.
All right. Your voice sounds just fine.
Whew. What a relief.
Yeah. Anyway, I feel like it's been a long time since we've done this. I think the last time we recorded was almost a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone following along in real time will not have heard that yet because it's yet to be released, but whatever. That's the joy of, at least for me, the upcoming academic year, which has removed all of my time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, anyway, what's happening? Oh, host topic. So the host topic this time is upgrades that you have done to your vintage computers. And we were talking about this a little bit ahead of time, and I think probably anything is fair game as long as it was done on a computer that is now vintage. So upgrades you did at the time, upgrades you have done recently that you weren't able to do back in the day, whatever. So we can go around and sort of talk about our thoughts on that. Jack, maybe you could start. You said you had something you could say.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot of things. So in recent times, I have upgraded like an Atari 2600. I put in a composite mod so that it had, mm-hmm. instead of just the like RF output. And that was pretty fun. Did that a few years ago. I actually broke out the soldering iron and did some things, and it felt good. Felt soldery. But like as far as actual mods to retro computers, the only ones that I've done were back in the day. So like in about probably 1984 or 85, when I had my Atari 400, I both swapped out the keyboard for another one, which was, that would just sort of like get it, open it up and take it out and plug in a different ribbon cable and put the thing in place. So that was a pretty simple upgrade. I did one more complicated upgrade to give the thing more RAM also. And that required soldering and things that were sort of beyond my skill level. So in retrospect, I didn't do the upgrade. I sent it off to the company that made the upgrade. I sent the whole thing to them, and they did it for me and sent it back.
Yeah.
Still counts.
That's probably wise.
Yeah, I could probably do it now. I wouldn't be worried about doing it now. But in those days, I don't think I'd really soldered anything at all yet. So I was like, what am I going to do with this? So anyway, both these things were extremely useful upgrades, like especially that RAM upgrade. Holy crap. Because I went through a thing with that Atari 400, which from the start only had 16K of RAM, which I had been playing games on it and doing some stuff. And I was like, okay, that's fine, I guess. And I bought a tape recorder so I could write basic programs and save them out and stuff. And later I was like, okay, I got to get a disk drive. So I got a disk drive. And that's when I discovered that, oh, the DOS takes up like 10K of the available RAM, which means you can't run any software at all on a 16K Atari if you load stuff from disk. So then I had to get the upgrade. So, but it made it so much better, obviously. No regrets.
All right.
No regrets.
Yeah, I was thinking a little bit. I wonder where the line is for upgrade, because, I mean, you got a disk drive. Is that an upgrade? Maybe it is an upgrade. Mm. You know, you got to open the box and plugged in the cable. Mm. I know that I was thinking about that in terms of the Apple II, and there are all these slots, you know, so it doesn't seem like much of an accomplishment to just put a card in a slot that you bought at the store, but it is kind of an upgrade. Anyway, Carrington, what thoughts did you have on upgrades to vintage computers?
I mostly put cards in slots. I feel attacked.
Sorry. But,
no, it's true, though. When I think back to, like, back in the day changes to computers, most of the time, if I was making a change, it was something that simple. It was various cards. Less so for the Apple II back then, but much more often for the various Macintoshes I had. You know, putting NuBus cards in, mostly for video things and stuff, was a standard change, a standard upgrade. And then hard drives and RAM, which back in the day were really easy to make changes. Boy, I hear my voice squeak on that word day. This is going to be a fun episode. So popping in more RAM, changing hard drives, that was like the standard. And it's very similar to what I do now when I get a vintage computer, because I've gone all emulation, or I'm attempting to. A couple more to get rid of. But when you have an old computer nowadays, you can very cheaply max out all its capabilities in a way you couldn't back in the day. So changing, spinning things to solid state things is the default way to go. One of the first times I did that was with my Apple IIe, or maybe it was the GS, when I got an SD floppy 2, which was my first SD card floppy emulator thing. And once you get one of those, it's like just groundbreaking. It's hard to go back to physical floppies again, or physical hard drives. And then there's the floppy EMU and the CFFA 3927 or whatever the number is. Like, that is just an unbelievably amazing upgrade. So it's the kind of thing, like with modern computers, once you switch from a spinning hard drive computer to a solid state hard drive computer, you really can't go back. It's such a speed difference. It's such a convenience difference. It's amazing. So that's the typical change I've did. I think for vintage computers that I own now or have owned recently, the biggest one, though, was probably in my Apple IIe, putting a RAMworks 3 card in, because I got the VGA daughter card for it. Uh-huh. And so suddenly that gave me not just more RAM, but VGA out, and a really easy way to use a big LCD monitor and have everything look great. And that was incredible. Like the kind of thing I couldn't have done back in the day. I wouldn't have been able to afford it. I probably didn't even know it existed. But having it now, that's the thing I think that made the biggest impact on that computer, more than the floppy stuff, more than anything, like playing a game and just having it on a, like, you know, 17-inch, but that's huge for an Apple II. Having a 17-inch LCD monitor just makes gaming and stuff on it so fun, and the VGA daughter card on the RAMworks. What's nice about it is it seems to introduce essentially no lag. So there are some VGA things mm-hmm. you can do with an Apple II, but they impact gaming, and the RAMworks 3 plus VGA is a great gaming setup. So I love it. If I look at changes I made, like, back in the day to computers, like I talked about, it's mostly sticking cards in, but of those, the one that stands out is, I think in my mind it was for a 2GS, but the more I think about it, I think it might have been for something like a Macintosh 2CI. Anyway, I ran a bulletin board, a BBS, for a while. It was a first-class BBS. I was on one. First-class was a Macintosh, at least I think of it as a Macintosh graphical BBS thing. And there was a big one in Toronto called Magic. And I was on that BBS for quite some time. And then I'd run previous BBSs, but I launched a first-class BBS because I liked that software so much. And so I'm pretty sure I must have run it on a Mac 2 of some sort. So I'm thinking a 2CI, 2CX, something like that. And I got a modem card, like it's a 4-port modem card. So suddenly I could have 4 modems, and I had to get 4 phone lines in. And I just felt like, you know, king of the world. Look at me with my 4-line BBS. I was just a monster, I tell you. It was fantastic. So that's one of my favorite upgrades. And it was as simple as putting a card in, but then also paying for 4 lines and getting 4 modems and such. And then that just became a dedicated BBS computer. And then for quite some time, and I loved it. And I think the most interesting upgrade or addition I've done to a computer was to a whole suite of Macintosh 7600s that I had at a cyber cafe my family and I ran for a while. I added Nintendo 64s and PlayStation 2s as upgrades. So the Macintosh 7600 was one of the line of Macs that had video in. And so just writing a front end that popped up a video input window and went full screen let you switch over on the computer and say, hey, if you're sick of surfing the web or whatever and you want to play Nintendo 64, just press this button, and suddenly the screen would become a Nintendo 64, but it's pumped through the computer so that we could monitor the time someone's playing because we're charging them by time. So that was probably the most interesting upgrade when I added a N64 to a 7600. And then eventually a carousel that would swap the cartridges on that. So that was pretty cool. So that's probably the weirdest upgrade I've done to a computer. But again, was basically card-based. So you and your cards are no good, Paul. You disparage me. You disparage me, sir.
That was pretty cool. Of course, when you first said that you upgraded the 7600 to a Nintendo 64, I thought that was by physically taking the 7600 away.
Could have been one way to do it, too.
Yeah.
No, just the video in. Like, I think people forget nowadays it's relatively easy to do it, but things like when the 840 AV and the 660 AV came out, and they were mind-blowing. Like, those AV parts, I think it was a daughter card or something, was unbelievable, the capabilities of those things. Mind-blowing. And then also in the later things like the 7600 and such, and I think the 8500 or whatever, all that era, it's so hard to keep track of which was which. The video in of capabilities of those is pretty sweet when you're dealing with a relatively low resolution input source. What about you? What have you done, Frankenstein-y?
Well, so I mean, I've done some of this same kind of like putting in an accelerator or putting in the CFFA 3000 kind of flash card solution to spinning media and stuff, and that helps a fair amount for like modern things. The one that I was thinking about is sort of a sad story in a way, but well, not ex- oh, here. I'll tell you the story, and you can decide what emotion
we'll tell you if it's sad.
Want to attribute to it. But so on the Apple II, there's a on the 5 1/4 inch. Floppies, there's a little notch on the side, and if you cover the notch, then it won't write to the floppy, and if you leave it open, then you can use it. So it's a way to protect things, just like on the old cassette tapes. You pop the thing out, and you can't write to it anymore. And I was a little kid and thought, this is just annoying, particularly because I wanted to use the back side, and punching these things was not... I didn't have a... I wasn't very good at punching it. I didn't have a dedicated disc puncher, so... My discs look pretty ratty.
I think it's kind of thinking is going to end in tragedy, Paul.
So I would, I would try to use, hole punchers or whatever. And so I have a bunch of discs that look like somebody took a bite out of them or something, because I just kept not quite getting it in the right spot. And, but anyway, the way the drive works, at least mine, I think they changed a little bit. I think maybe the later ones used some sort of optical, detector, but in the one that I had, it was a sort of a physical little latch that would pop down into the space that the hole in the side of the disc provides. So when the thing is popped down in there, then the right signal won't get through, and if it's not popped down there, then the right signal will be fine. So the upgrade that I did was to make my disc drive always be able to write by physically removing that latch. I broke it off.
That is dangerous, dangerous activity.
Which is a really bad idea. Don't ever do this. Because, so at least it turned out that the default state of the thing was write enabled. That would have been pretty bad, actually. But the other thing is, actually, there are some things, like Wizardry is the game that comes to mind, that actually use that as a way to... That's like part of the copy protection. That they make the assumption that if you can write to the disk, then this is a copy. Because if it were an original, that thing would be, there would be a hole. Which means, I had no way to make the computer believe that this was write protected. So, anyway, so I'm not sure if that was an upgrade, but it was certainly, it's one that I remember.
I don't know if it's an upgrade, but it was a grade.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You don't know the direction yet. A D grade.
I suppose actually this is going to mean that in amongst my many piles of disc twos that I have around, I can figure out which one was my original one.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. You'd be on the hunt.
Yeah.
Or just donate that one to a Kansas Fest garage giveaway as a little time bomb for somebody in the future.
Right. Well, the thing is, you know, I did this actually pretty early on, and it never actually caused a problem, which is interesting, and I'm lucky. But, like, you know, so there was never a way that I could keep my disk from being initializable and that kind of thing. Anyway, nothing else is really jumping to mind, I guess. I mean, like, I have, there's a bunch of stuff that I would like to try to do that I have yet to get around to. I don't think that counts.
I don't think it counts either.
I agreed.
Okay. Okay, I'll move on. Unless there's any other upgrade topics you wanted to hit.
No, is there anything you guys have always wanted to do but never did? Like specifically? One thing I always thought about, I always kind of toyed with the idea, was painting a computer. Like, say, forget this retrobrighting stuff. I'm going to make a, you know, a bright fuchsia Apple IIe. And I always toyed with that idea. I have frequently been a person who stickers his computers. I have stickered up many a laptop.
Oh, yeah.
I've subsequently, on my last few, gotten smart and put down a clear laptop cover on top of it, and then stick it on top of that. So when you get rid of the computer, you can just peel everything off really easily. So pro tip there. Took me a while to realize that one. But I've never like painted a computer, though I always thought like a fuchsia one or a lime green computer would be very cool and right up my alley. I just never got around to it. I've just sort of toyed with it for 40 years. So we'll see if it ever happens. What about you guys?
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. I definitely have thought about that, you know, sort of early on. I got a Macintosh SE30. It was just a terrible, terrible color. I mean, it still is that same terrible color. It's just yellow, but not a nice uniform yellow. It's kind of like it looks terrible. And looking at something that's yellowed like that does make you think like, oh, you know, if I just painted this purple, this would be not a problem. At this past Kansas Fest, there were a couple of, I think they were like Mac 128s or something like that. That one was painted blue and one was painted pink. And I don't know if there was a symbolism behind that, but there were these like, you know, it was pretty cool looking. These just like little blue and pink computers.
So. The 840 AV is one of my all-time favorite Macs that I ever owned. I adored that thing. But whenever you look at them for sale now, that's one that has really weathered the years poorly, because the middle part of the case is like a horseshoe shape of metal.
Yeah.
And then the front and back were plastic, and they are dramatically different looking now on any computer that comes up for sale. So I got an 840 AV in the future sometime. I would 100% paint it because they just look terrible now, which is such a shame, because that is a brilliant and beautiful model. What about you, Jack?
Yeah, for me, I guess the kind of thing that I wanted to do and never did was more about various pieces of hardware that I wanted to have back in the day and didn't get around to for one reason or another. Mostly, probably, usually money, like I was a kid. But, like, and some of that stuff I've been trying to see if I can get into acquiring some things or similar things these days. But, yeah, it's nothing really specific that I wanted to change any of the computers that I've had, really. Well, actually, I guess I have another weird mod that I did a long time ago to an Amiga 500. Which is that it annoyed me that I had, you know, it's all in one computer, right? I really wanted to have an external keyboard. And what I did was I got hold of an Amiga 2000 keyboard, but I didn't know the wiring, like how to actually wire that up to the inside of a 500. So I ended up taking my Amiga 500 keyboard, sticking it in the shell of that, soldering up the wires inside of that, and then the wires at the other end of the cable into a plug that I plugged in. So, and that thing is probably floating out in the world somewhere. Somebody has a keyboard that looks just like an Amiga 2000 keyboard, but has just a random wiring standard, whatever I came up with, whatever order for those five or six wires. And it'll probably short out somebody's Amiga 2000. There's my time bomb.
That's like cool. Yeah, and there definitely is, mentioning sort of like other stuff we'd like to try to do. One of the things that I've been planning to spend some time with are like coprocessor cards. To put in a 68000 or various 6809. You know, the various kinds of coprocessor cards you can get, or even just a Z80 card. I haven't played much with those. Z80 cards obviously are fairly easy to get. But some of those other ones are pretty unusual. It'd be interesting to play with them. I don't know. Even just thinking about that now is kind of daunting in terms of what time it would take, but it would be fun. Actually, that reminds me of, now this is a tangent on a tangent, I guess, but there's a 3.5-inch disk drive for the Apple II called the Unidisc 3.5 that actually has a 6502 in it. And that would be actually something that I also want to try. I've seen some people do some stuff with this, but actually sort of like send off, you know, some sort of program to run in the drive while you're running something else on the computer.
You could do a battle bots type game where you two people write little bits of code, and then if you win, the disk ejects. And if I win, the disk does it, and you have to wait 30 seconds and you see who won. It's like, oh, woo!
Right. Yeah, I think the Commodore 64 drive also has a 6502 in it. I don't know to what extent it's programmable independently like that. But
come to think of it, that'd be a fun way to do a head-to-head computer thing where you each have computers, you do a network game, but you face your floppy disks at each other, and the winner can eject their floppy disk and punch the other person's floppy drive.
That's cool. I think there was, I remember seeing, this is going to be hard to find, but somebody had rigged up something that would, I think it was sort of like reset their server or something like that, in some sort of computer room. And what they did was they basically stuck a relatively old, you know, Dell or something in front of the switch at just the right height so that they could eject the CD tray and hit the switch remotely.
That's awesome.
Which I thought was pretty excellent. Somewhere maybe I'll be able to find that. I don't know. But
now that's an upgrade.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay. If we're done with that, maybe I will run through at least a couple of things that showed up in listener feedback over the past month. One thing is that Jason on Facebook pointed out that the Atari 8-Bit Project's book is released, and you can get it on Lulu, and we'll have a link in the show notes. This is the printed version of the projects that you can get at atariprojects.org. So the projects themselves are still available like they were, but it is now also in a printed book if you want to actually take notes in it or have it open by your computer or whatever. So it's pretty cool. It's not too expensive. It's at least when I'm looking at it right now, I'm not sure if it's some kind of discount, but it's like $20. Lulu is publishing on demand, I guess is what you would call it. So it's actually kind of an interesting platform for just general, small run books of this sort. Jack, have you looked much at this Atari Projects? I think Earl was very pleased about the existence of it.
Yeah.
But I think we talked about it a little before.
Yeah. I've looked at it a little before. It's a nice sort of intro. So especially if you're new to the Atari 8-bit computing line, like if you follow the things in this, the suggestions in this, it's kind of a nice intro to what sort of the lay of the land is, kind of how things work and what some of the common things are to do and podcasts to listen to and all this kind of thing. So it seems nice.
So in fact, for somebody like me who's maybe interested in kind of learning a little bit more about it, but doesn't really know a lot, this might actually be a good way to get into it.
Yep, I would think so. And there's a wide range of stuff from doing things with hardware to different kinds of software and different kinds of all sorts of third-party things and testing your RAM and just all sorts of stuff.
That's cool.
It's pretty neat.
Testing your RAM sounds like a phrase. You're really testing my RAM.
Okay. Pat wrote over email, and so I'm going to say what he wrote over email, at least in part here, in case somebody out there has some ideas. Maybe we here can say something, but I don't feel very competent. Pat has an SWTP C6800, so I forget what that is, Southwestern Technology, something like that, I don't know.
Southwest Technical Products Corporation.
Okay, perfect.
He said, having just Googled it now.
Oh, okay. So he wants to sell it. It was turned on 15 years ago and works. He's not super excited about shipping it. But he would love to sort of demo it to see if it works. But at the same time, last time it was turned on was 15 years ago. It's one of these older computers. The shape of it is like, the MSI or whatever. It's just like a big box, right? And probably has things in it that would threaten to explode. So he just sort of wrote for advice. And I don't feel like I'm competent to give much advice, but maybe you out there have something to suggest. I have one thing I might suggest, but any either of you, Jack or Carrington, have a thing you wanted to say about this?
I have no idea.
First thing
what
is take out any batteries, if there are any, just get them out. Because what the heck?
My guess also, is this predates any sort of real-time clock.
Yeah,
though.
That's what I would assume as well. If you turn it on and it pops, it might pop capacitors. So yeah, here's the thing. Let's be cynical. There are only two types of computers on eBay, working and untested. So
yeah.
If you turn it on and it blows, then you're going to sell it as untested.
That's right.
This is awful and that's mean, but that's how people seem to do things.
Yeah.
You'll generally get a lot more for a computer if it's working. Like if you show it working and it's an old thing, then that's a big deal. So it might be worth the gamble. Worst case scenario, if you turn it on and it pops a capacitor, you'll know which one because it'll be the stinky one spewing smoke and take a picture and say, it was working 15 years ago, but recently it's not because of this capacitor. It has blown up. And yeah. Most technical people look at it and go, okay, I can replace the capacitor. We talked about it a few episodes ago. It's not really that big a deal. Yeah, I can do it, so a lot of people can do it. I mean, if I can do it, everybody can do it. So
I think these are big, or at least, you know, these could be the bigger ones that could both explode more dramatically and be sort of
harder
to find.
That's just exciting. Film it.
Yeah, that's just more fun.
That's true.
What you'll lose
get them clicks.
In eBay value, you'll pick up in YouTube ad revenue. So just film it, exploding old computer. That's going to be amazing. You'll get 10 million links and you'll make a bunch of AdWords stuff. So
yeah.
I don't think there's economically anything to lose here.
I was going to say, I think he's located in sort of my region. And one thing that occurred to me is that I know the Vintage Computer Federation Mid-Atlantic group often has workshops and stuff. And this is exactly the kind of thing that
that's
would be
idea.
Perfect for that. So, and you know, that's generally in New Jersey, so it's not, you know, it's not convenient to everywhere, but that might be even an excuse to go to one of these workshops because there'd be a bunch of people there who would know how to maybe, you know, do whatever reconditioning you might be able to, or how to bring up the power slowly so that it minimizes the chance of anything exploding and that kind of thing.
That's smart. That's a very good tip. Because the reality is, if you had an old Apple II and you were concerned about turning it on, the place you'd want to turn it on is Kansas Fest. Because there's that repair room we talked about last time.
Right.
There'd be people there that could get it working again if it goes horribly wrong. So maybe powering it up at that kind of event is a good idea. Plus, it'd be a fun session. Like you just do your own session, powering it up. Let's see. It's explodey time.
That's right.
And if it doesn't explode, you can demo to people what it is and what it does.
Exactly. And if it does, you could hand out goggles for people in the front row to wear.
Like Gallagher.
Well, maybe a less sledgehammer action, but yeah.
Anyway, yeah. So I think it is an interesting thing to wonder about. It occurs to me I have something that might be kind of in that category too. I should take a look at what its power supply is. I have plugged it in, I'm pretty sure. And sort of recklessly just... It didn't do anything, but it not only did it not explode, it didn't do anything. But that is my Jupiter 2, pretty much the only one I've ever heard of. But okay, so let's see. We had a couple of emails from Klaus, who's going back and listening to some of
who's catching up on the episodes. That's super fun.
Yeah. So one about episode 70 and one about episode 74. So I think that's got to be before I'd even been on it at all. But so episode 70, though, I remember the idea here because it was a discussion of the Commodore 64 Apple II chess battle. And so Carrington, you and Earl actually...
Oh, that was super fun to do.
Yeah.
Right. And the Apple II won. Ha. Suck it, Earl.
Yeah. I forget, was it... You manually fed their moves to each other, right? They didn't actually communicate.
I think that was it. So I played the moves that his computer offered. So I think it's so long ago now, it's hard to remember. But yeah, I think that was it. We were playing. I think it didn't go head to head. We just fed the moves that the one computer said to the other computer and had them play off against each other. I think we put it up as a very difficult to watch YouTube video.
Yeah. I do remember watching it. I might have watched it as it was happening. Is conceivable.
Yeah, it was super fun. Super, super fun.
Yeah. But anyway, so if you wanted to go back and look, there is a YouTube channel that, you know, an RCR podcast YouTube channel, and you can watch, you know, the many hours of chess go by if you want. It is kind of interesting. There are so some of these episodes back at that time were actually recorded as like Google Hangouts. So there are there's video of you know, the people who are participating talking.
Yeah, we used that instead of Skype for a while, and since it was a video based thing, we said, well, let's just record it and stick it on YouTube.
Yeah, so it was pretty fun. I remember sitting in the, you know, writing snarky comments in the chat.
You could still do that now. Yeah. We have the chat window open for this show.
That's true.
Snark away, Paul.
All right. But anyway, so Klaus was, you know, sort of pointing out that he was at that episode and was saying that he did something sort of like that back in at the end of 2000. So he pitted let's see, a C64 against, I'm trying to read this now, on the fly here, which computers he was using. But
64 ZX Spectrum and the CPC-464, the Amstrad.
Yes, I see. Okay, yes, he listed those, and that was because they were the ones participating. And the C64 won that one. Anyway, he gave a link. We'll put the link in the show notes so you can check it out if you want to. That has the information about this tournament. So if you want to take a look at that, that's cool. And then Klaus actually also wrote about episode 74, sort of talking a little bit about copy protection and backing up old floppies and things. And Klaus said that he had a story to share. Should I have been saying his name all along? But it's basically just sort of about going through and kind of like cracking things, you know, so to try to figure out how to make a copy of something that was intentionally copy protected. And so this particular issue had to do with, I think, having some unformatted tracks at the end of the disk, and so he was trying to figure out how to copy all but copy, you know, a disk that had unformatted tracks at the end. And it looks like it was using CPM, which is something that that's a operating system that I would have no idea even where to begin with copy protection.
Me too.
So pretty cool. Oh, and he also objects somewhat to the idea that Windows is an operating system rather than just a shell over DOS, at least in the parts that we talk about. But anyway. I think that was it for the listener feedback. So then I guess we can move on to the various items of interest in news that we found. And Carrington, you are alphabetically first. So what do you have?
Ooh, way to go. Start with C. I've got something starting with B, which is back to, I think it's pronounced Borgas Avenue, finding Atari's Lost World Headquarters. So over on Atari.io is a great long article with a bunch of photographs about a fellow who goes and seeks out Atari World Headquarters, the building in an area called Moffett Park, which was, I guess, an industrial park. And there were a bunch of buildings in there that were related to Atari. And there's the old Atari World Headquarters and also a building that was the Chuck E. Cheese head and just a bunch of stuff. And so this guy goes and walks around there today and looks at the buildings and discusses what was in those buildings at the time and how they look very different than he had imagined them look. And he had a comic from back then that showed like this massive Atari headquarters with a monorail and stuff, like a kind of a perception of what it would be like in the future. It is not like that. But it's really neat. And then he's joined by an Atari designer named Reagan Cheng, who was an Atari designer back in the day, one of the two people who worked on the Atari 5200, and he worked on the 1200 XL. So he was like an industrial designer for Atari. And so he joins and they walk around and they talk about the different buildings and the impact they had on design and like this big staircase that you'd see when you walk in the Atari headquarters and different stars that came to visit. It's a really interesting article. When I think of old like computer headquarters, like being an Apple guy, I think of, you know, One Infinite Loop. So I'm completely out of the loop when it comes to the Atari stuff. But nonetheless, I found the article really interesting and the photos just fascinating. Like, even though it's just simple things like here's a photo of a receptionist desk, but you get caught up in the story of it. Like, this is where Atari was and this headquarters and a lady named Geraldine used to sit at this desk and she was the receptionist at Jack Tramiel's when Jack Tramiel was in charge, and just like all these things. I'm like, here's a basketball hoop that used to be used back then, and here are pillars that used to hold an Atari sign. Like, it's a lot of used to stuff. But I don't know. I found it fascinating. So I would strongly recommend it. It's really, really an interesting article.
Yep, very cool.
Even if you're not an Atari person.
I've scrolled through it. I haven't read it yet. I think I saw it referred to, but I didn't follow a link to it before. But I'm glad
you're referring you
I'm
to it.
I'm glad you mentioned it because it seems very, very cool.
Yeah. Consider yourself referred.
Well, and it's neat to have had a chance to get those sort of remembered stories and things, because it's quite possible that photographs of the time won't ever surface, and it's quite possible that they wouldn't reveal things that the person can actually remember. So.
Mm. Yeah, he says it's like walking around a dead theme park, like one that's closed down. And it's a really fascinating article with a lot of nostalgia in it. And I think if you're interested in vintage Ataris, you'll find it a really interesting read. But I'm not really an old Atari guy, although I've always had a soft spot for Atari. I like their stuff. And I found it fascinating beginning to end. So strong recommendation.
It's interesting that the buildings are not otherwise in use, though.
One building, he said it was divided up. Used to be one big building, and now it's two. And so I think it got used after that. But it's really just like a shut down area for the most part.
Huh. Interesting.
It's America. You know, it's kind of on the downslide as a country.
Okay.
It's not going to be around that much longer.
All right. Continuing on, is this more Atari? Maybe it isn't. Anyway, Jack, what's your thing? You have another thing here.
Yeah, so this was referred to me by a friend of mine that I work with, a guy named Shuao. There's this new magazine, this online free magazine called Paged Out, and it's not specifically retro exactly. Well, it is, but it's many things. So their sort of description says it's about programming, hacking, security hacking, retro computers, modern computers, electronics, demo scene, and other similar topics. And what's cool is it's a thing so they have one issue out. It's in PDF form, and it's like 100 and some pages, I think. And each article is exactly one page. Okay, it's 60 some pages. So it's like each article is like a one page about how to do this weird trick in Unix or this odd thing in Python, or why does C do this, or how can we make a game out of putting stuff in a PNG? And like, it's just like a lot of interesting stuff, and I have not even scratched the surface of it yet, but it's super cool and super fun.
There's one particular page that's amazing called Hackulele, and it talks about a thing called, there's a smart ukulele, again, I pronounce ukulele, called the Populately. And so there's a one-page article here called Hackulele, and it says the point is to use a bloated, kind of ugly app to connect your uke over Bluetooth, sending commands to blink the lights behind the frets. And it talks about like gamifying that on how to hack this smart ukulele. I'm like, I'm in, this is awesome. Yep. Because it's got little light up frets, I guess, to tell you where to put your fingers, but you can instead display stuff and try to make animations on it. Fantastic.
That's pretty cool. Yep. Or you could also make it. I don't know how you can figure out what people are actually playing, but I'm just thinking a little bit about how lighting up the LEDs could tell you where to play, or it could actually make it much, much harder to play by lighting up all these things that you're not supposed to hit.
Well, I think once you really get really good and you don't need to look down anymore, it just becomes part of your stage presence. It's like a cool lit up ukulele that just like displays cool messages or dirty words or whatever.
Right. So the coolness you get out of that is sort of displaced by the uncoolness of the ukulele, so you wind up sort of at a net zero.
or at least you hope to.
Yeah. Now, Jackie, didn't you say once that you have like ukuleles strewn about your house?
I have a couple, yeah. I play more ukulele than guitar these days, and have for a while. But it's, I don't know, it's nice. I for a long time didn't ever give a ukulele two thoughts until, I don't know, 8 or 10 years ago, I saw something online. I was like, wow, look at that guy play. And I was like, that kind of got me thinking about it more. And I found that it's way easier for me to have a ukulele lying around that I can pick up and strum on for a few minutes rather than a guitar that's going to be in a case that I got to pull out and find somewhere to put the case down and open it. And then I've got the guitar and I've got, I got to put the guitar down somewhere. It's just like, it's so convenient and so handy to have a small instrument. Yeah, it's like going from your... Mm-hmm. Big old Apple II to your nice Apple IIc.
I see. Exactly like that.
So, yeah. Anyway, we're just sidetracking and sidetracking. But this thing, Paged Out, is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And I thought that, even though it's not specifically a retro-themed thing, I think there's a lot of stuff that is of interest for our listeners here because there are all sorts of crazy things.
There is indeed. I'm fascinated by so much of this. I just found a thing called QuineSnake. So Quine, I don't know if you guys know what a Quine is. It's a stupid thing. It's a program that doesn't take any inputs, and it just, the only thing it does is it prints out its own source code. So it's like a exercise. I think if you take programming classes, they make you make a Quine. So this thing called QuineSnake. And so it's a Quine. It's a program that just prints out its own source code. But then after it's printed, it compiles itself, and then it runs itself and plays a snake game over its own source code. So it uses it, like it highlights stuff in it, and it now starts to take input after it's done the Quine, and you can move a little snake color thing going over top of its own source code, trying to eat up little bits of its own source. That is pretty cool. So there's a lot of really creative stuff in here. Like, oh my goodness.
Yeah. The one page requirement is actually kind of neat, because it means that you need not have a really big idea. Some little idea, write it up. There you go.
And also, as you scroll down, every time you land anywhere, you're looking at a new thing.
Yeah.
And it's massive.
That's interesting.
Cool. Yep. So nice find.
That page, in fact, there's a next issue progress tracker that tells you like how many articles they have for the next one. Once they get past 50 in a sort of like 60-ish range, then they'll have enough to put the next one out. So it really is kind of like a collaborative thing.
Yep. Yes, it seems to be a free-for-all for anybody who wants to add interesting stuff to it. It seems like it's a pretty straightforward thing. So
yeah.
Go out there and get your weird project in this weird zine. And all the weirdos will love you.
Yes, goal achieved. Okay, so I have, the next thing I have here is, it's kind of related to the clear case thing that we saw for the Mac SE models, but this is a Kickstarter for an injected molded clear case for Apple II and Apple II Plus. So it's by the same people who did the clear case SE. It is Mac Effects LLC. And the plan is basically to make a clear version of the Apple II case, the one that came before the 2E. So either Apple II or Apple II Plus. And there are 59 days to go, so this just got listed. As we're recording, there are 59 days to go. They're looking.
We're so current.
Yes, that's right. And then a month later, this will get released. So they're already at almost $7,000 of a $29,000 goal. They have a couple of different stretch goals. So one of them is that maybe there's only one stretch goal, but the stretch goal is a floppy drive with a clear case, so a disk 2 floppy drive case, which is also pretty cool looking. I think that looks less cool, honestly, than the Apple II case. And I think one of the options you have is to get a charcoal. So it could be clear, or you can get a charcoal one. And the thing that's kind of cool with the charcoal one is it's the idea, at least, is supposed to be that it's relating conceptually to the version of the Apple II Plus that Bell and Howell sold to schools. So anyone who kind of grew up around this time may well have found like a black Apple II Plus in their school. And that's just because Bell and Howell had a way to market things to schools, and Apple sort of partnered with them. But so there's a whole bunch of these Apple II Pluses that are just black. And I myself, that was where I started, so I have this like soft spot for those. But one of the clear case options is to get a charcoal one.
Looks nice.
I think we talked about there was like a test run for this on eBay recently where they listed a clear, I suspect it was this case, because somebody was listing a clear case on eBay.
Yes, right.
For like $3,500 or some huge amount to test, and set it to test like interest. And then they relisted it and it sold again for a very high amount. I don't know, $2,000, $1,500, some huge amount. So I'm kind of surprised that, and then it comes out here and it's sold for $150. So too bad sucker who bought the first one. I think these look really cool. I like clear case things. I get that there's like, I can see the argument against it, like the whole Emperor's New Clothes thing, because you can also have a even more invisible case by just, removing the case. They go, there you go. If you want it to look like this, take the damn case off. What's with the clear clothing? But I still think it's a really neat thing. I don't know that I'll personally get one, because I'm trying to go all all emulated. So I can emulate the lack of something by just not having something. So I can do my own clear cases for as many things as I want. Yeah. But I think for $150, I think that it's a reasonable thing, a very reasonable price for this case.
Yeah, no, it does seem like, the lowest sort of level that gets you something is $150, which gets you the base case and a lid. If you go a little bit higher, then you also get emblems, so little badges. And in fact, actually, the badges, they have some pictures of the badges that go sort of at the front and the back of the power, or back, you know, sort of where the video connectors are and stuff. And they look real. They look so real that they worry me a little bit. it may be that we have reached the end of the ability to detect, original service parts from these.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh well.
Because, like, there's one of the things here where you, for $350 or whatever, you get the Bell & Howell charcoal case kit, and that comes with, like, the base, the lid, Bell & Howell badges, audio stickers on it with the foil, like, the whole, it's basically a forge kit. So, Okay, so you have 30 days to buy truly collectible Bell & Howell machines. Without worrying about it.
I assume that this is still translucent. No one will mistake it for an actual Bell & Howell, but...
It's a transparent forgery.
Yeah, exactly. another thing that's actually kind of neat is that at least some of the stuff that people are doing in terms of, like, modern cards will often include sort of little LEDs that light up and do interesting things. You know, normally you won't be able to see that inside your case, but if you have a clear case, you can actually see the, you know, whatever it is, the SD card accesses or the speed thing or whatever going.
A clear case you can code forever.
Yeah. That's right. Anyway, it looks cool. It looks like Vintage Micros is also involved in this. I'm pretty sure Vintage Micros was where that clear case was listed and sold. That would have been like the prototype. So, oh, actually, that's interesting. I wonder if they bought it. It says the prototype was acquired from Vintage Micros, which I originally took to mean that they worked with John Whittle to, like, set this up. But maybe they just bought the one that John Whittle made. I don't know.
I like it. Now let's knock it off and get our money back.
Yeah. That's cool. Anyway, looks cool. I'm quite interested in it. I haven't yet actually, backed it, but it's pretty tempting. And I think if this does well enough, they might, go ahead and go with the 2E. But at this point, this is just for the 2 and 2 plus. And obviously, you need to provide your own, like, innards. So this is just the case. All right. I think that's enough of that. And we can move on to Carrington with more modern upgrades.
Oh, I've got a Wombat for you. So Big Mess O'Wires. Great name. Great company. Famous for the bathtub full of connectors, whatever.
Yeah.
The Wombat is as it puts here, a bidirectional ADB to USB and USB to ADB converter for keyboards and mice. So if you want to plug old ADB computers and mice into a modern USB computer, or you want to plug modern USB devices, mice and keyboard, into old computers, this is your bidirectional converter. It takes no drivers, software. Basically just plug it in, and it stands between the keyboard and mice and the computer, and everything just works. I don't know if anybody's told John Gruber about this, because he goes on and on about his love of the ADB Apple, what is it, the Mac Keyboard 2, I think.
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
And also the adapters for that everyone uses, I don't think work with the latest versions of Mac, and so people get concerned if you like that particular brand of computer, model of keyboard. You were running out of time to be able to use it, but here is a new solution. I think this looks amazing. I think this is just totally fab. It's $50, $60 if you want to get it in a case, and then you can chuck in $500 to get an ADB cable if you don't have one of those. Totally reasonable, I think. Fully tested, comes assembled. It's not like a kit or anything. You just buy it as a product. Pretty amazing. There isn't a photo of a bathtub full of them, which is a shame, and I think a missed marketing opportunity. I want everything from Big Mess Wire to come as a bathtub full.
Yeah.
But amazing. Like, it continues the streak of amazing stuff from Boom Wow.
Right. Yeah, they were the ones who did the floppy emu. Yeah, I did, in fact, get one of these. I haven't actually tried to plug in anything, with it, but I have plenty of ADB machines, old Macs and the next also. And the case looks pretty nice, I have to say. It's probably worth getting the case. It's $10.
This is if you wanted to build a new computer in a hopefully already not working retro case, like you stick an LCD inside a old Mac SE or whatever, or people that put Mac Minis inside old computers to get them to run, and you want that vintage, total vintage feel, you'd want to use old keyboards and mice on the outside of it as well. And so this would be a great adapter for that. So you'd stick this plus a Mac Mini inside an old computer, and you can use an old keyboard and then run an emulator. And it's almost like you didn't do any of that work and you just have an old computer.
Right. But maybe one that won't die immediately.
Exactly. I think it was really great. I'm super tempted to get one of these. My problem is from a minimalist standpoint, where a guy does want to have a bunch of stuff, this is very much a, just in case thing for me. Like these things only exist for so long. In the future, am I going to want one of these? I don't have a need for it now, but like, will I regret not buying one? But then it's just going to go in that little Tupperware bin I have of just in case I ever need them cards and stuff. Mm-hmm. And what do I want to just like die with that Tupperware bin? I don't know. So maybe I'll break down and get one. I think it looks really good, and I think it's totally worth the money, and I think it looks fab. So we will see. We will see.
It's also really cool that it goes both directions. So you don't even have to think about, like, which model do I get, It'll do both.
Yeah, totally. Like, it looks like the perfect implementation of this thing. If you wanted one of these, this is the thing. Because it runs on, the USB side of it can be Windows, OS X, or Linux, and old stuff, basically anything with ADB. So Apple II things, the 2GS rather, and any old Macintosh or a Next computer. So pretty flexible.
All right, Jack, you have something that you have not provided a link for, so
yeah,
you cannot follow along.
I'll tell you guys. I'll figure out a link later. So Steve Boswell of Atari8bit.net, he's done a number of interesting hardware and software projects over the years that he's posted there. And his latest thing, which he's not yet posted there, but it's posted about in Facebook, is he's made a series of cool cases for the S-Drive Max, which is one of the SD card solutions for the Atari 8-bits. And basically what he's done, he's modeled them after old Atari's old floppy drives, smaller versions of the floppy drives. So you can get it like the 810, which is what came out with the 400 and 800, or you can get one that looks like the 10, what's it called? The 1010? No, 1050, sorry. The one that came out with the XL line. And the later one that came out with the XE line, what's called the XF551 or something. I think it's the one that looks like one of the cassette drives also. So basically the idea is, instead of just having your SD card reader thing in a generic box, you have one that looks like a bit of old Atari gear, but appropriately scaled down. So, and I will find some way to find a link to this. I don't seem to really grab a link to the Facebook articles about this. It's in the Atari 8-bit computers group anyway, where there's a lot of other interesting stuff as well. If nothing else, I'll just link to that group.
Oh, Facebook. So awful.
Yeah.
So awful in so many ways.
He may have posted this on Twitter also. Anyway, I'll find links to some of it somewhere to add to our show notes. So
I haven't been on Facebook in so long, and all of my retro friends are constantly hanging out on Facebook. You nasty, terrible people.
Yep, it's bad.
Trying to drag me back to that awful site that's terrible for the world. I'll break down eventually.
Cool.
So I can only hold out so long. Here in the September that never ended.
So Paul has found the correct link for this on the Atari 8bit.net website, which I had not found.
Yay.
Good job.
Hooray.
And yeah, these things look pretty cool. They don't... not a perfect match for the colors, because like the, I don't know, but that's just the way it is. But
pretty good, though.
Pretty
These
good.
Look great.
Yep.
Yeah. I've seen some kind of similar things people have done with like the Commodore equivalents, whatever it is, the SD2, I don't know what it is, SD2IEC. Yes, that's right. Yeah, I think that is a really kind of cute way to run your little SD solution.
Yeah. It's kind of neat.
The SD floppy, too. That you mentioned, Carrington, at the very beginning is a little bit like that. It's kind of abstract, but it is a little disk drive looking thing. It's very cute.
I love it. It's still one of my favorite things I ever got for an Apple II, because it was my first SD card thing for an old computer, and it just it was lovely and it's small and it just worked. Kind of awkward to click around the little button to scroll through 16 different options or whatever, one at a time, only in one direction. But still, you know, worked every time, all the time. Never regretted that purchase at all.
Yeah. Love it.
Yeah, but these look great. I like in the SD drive, Max, Scythier is saying how doing the 3D modeling for this was difficult because he didn't have 3D software. He says, Blender feels like it needs a better brain than the one I own. Nice.
Yep. Understandable.
All right. Cool. Let's see. So I have the next one. And so what I have here, this is basically something that Jason shared to Facebook. So it was feedback, but I'm stealing it. It's a fairly involved post at codetapper.com with hidden messages in Amiga games. So it's essentially, you know, basically just sort of, it's kind of like Easter eggs, really, but it's a very large file, particularly if you know the Amiga games scene or even, like, use them still. It's kind of interesting to kind of look through and see where you can find, you know, like, these little messages to people. So, you know, this case is a dummy file that says, you know, yeah, this is a dummy file. Might as well be used for additional remarks. I'm sort of skimming through them now, and it's, you know, it's taking me a long time just to get to the, like, the G's. So anyway, it looks pretty interesting. I haven't really read through it very carefully, but it did. So I wanted to point it out, and it also reminded me a little bit of another article that was published in Vice. It was from June 2016, so not super recent, but it's called It Took 33 Years for Someone to Find the Easter Egg in This Apple II Game. And we probably talked about it when that happened, but this is basically just a little message that the author just included in this game, where, I mean, essentially, this is Gumball, by the way, is the name of the game. And I think it was 4AM that found this. So, I mean, essentially there was a little, I forget now how this worked, but there's basically like a code that you have to type in, you know, after you've seen the various levels. So if you type the right thing at the end, it'll say, you know, you made it, either you're an excellent game player or program breaker. And then it gives you an actual code for more puzzles and stuff. And so 4AM actually tweeted to the author and got a reply that said, well done. I assumed it would take 1,000, but you solved it in a mere 33 years. Anyway, yeah, so that wasn't actually the thing that I was going to link to. What I was linking to was the hidden messages in Amiga games. So this reminded me of it. And then one last thing I found on the cuttingroomfloor.net site is a list of developer messages on a game called Dark Lord from Datasoft. I hadn't actually seen these before, but it says that in all the sectors in Track 0 on Side B, all have messages from the author. So they start with software by Kyle Freeman, you know, copyright 1987. And then there's a message that's like, in one sector it says, do not copy, get a date. Do not copy, play fetch with Fido. Do not copy, go to Disneyland. It's pretty funny, actually. So sector 12 says Apple II forever. But anyway, it's pretty funny. And there are many more of these, but this is as many as I found before I decided, you know, I was done preparing for this show.
I don't know the Dark Lord game. What type of game is it?
That is a good question. I do not know. I don't know it either.
Okay, so it looks like it's a graphical adventure game put up by Datasoft. Okay, cool. I want to play it then.
Yeah.
I like adventure games. I like them all.
Yeah, I guess it must be somewhat rare. I certainly do not have it. So there you go. That's evidence already.
Cool.
But excellent. I think we have now wandered off the end of the items of interest and news. And the next thing to talk about is the upcoming show roundup, and I'm pleased to report that we no longer have to talk about Fujiyama 2019 in Langenfeld, Germany, because it ended today.
We have to say one thing, though. Kevin Savitz did go.
Yes.
But Jack...
I didn't go.
Oh, Jack.
I didn't go.
You didn't go.
What is my deal?
That's right. So now we will not need to hear about that again for, you know, until we get the dates for Fujiyama 2020, or whenever the next one is. But maybe we can hear from Kevin what it was like. Also coming up is the Tandy Assembly 2019 in Springfield, Ohio, September 27th to 29th. That's pretty soon. And the Retro Gathering on September 28th, which Jack might go to.
Yep, I'll probably go.
Okay.
It's very, very close by.
We've heard it before.
Well, I have been before, too, so.
That's true. And with that, a word from our sponsor.
For those parents who realize that $600 isn't too much to spend to expand their child's world, Radio Shack has the perfect gift. The TRS-80 computer. The most significant investment a parent can make. Programs for your child's education or your business, finance, and home use. Let your children discover tomorrow's technology today. The TRS-80, the biggest name in little computers. Only at Radio Shack, a Tandy company.
Right, pay attention, Bond. This is the Sinclair ZX Spectrum Plus 2. It's a fully operational computer with 128K memory, but it comes with three James Bond games and a light gun that fires armor-piercing shells. Now that's your assignment.
No, no, don't sit in that chair!
Sorry, Bond. Haven't perfected that yet. The Sinclair ZX Spectrum Plus 2.
And we're back. Today, for the host's retro computing gift idea, we have collectively found an Atari joystick controller pendant on Etsy. I didn't actually look up how much this costs, so all I can say is that it's about 102 Swedish kroner.
It's probably about 10 bucks.
Okay. It's actually very funny. Actually, Jack, did you want to describe it?
Yeah, sure. Well, I was searching for Atari jewelry, as one does, and I found this on Etsy. Someone just taken a joystick controller cord and lopped off the joystick part and just used the cord to form a pendant. So like the actual like chain you would have is the cord, and then the pendant hanging down is the 9-pin DIN plug at the end of the cord, lopped off, forming the little loop that goes around the other parts like the chain. So it's basically, it's like you have a 9-pin DIN plug hanging around your neck, which is kind of cool. Like, it's also the kind of thing that...
Like an albatross.
You could probably just make this your own if you have the parts, which many people probably do. But, like, it's kind of neat. I thought it was funny.
So, the thing that did strike me, and I'm curious about this, is this a thing that is relatively plentiful? Like, should we be sad that this is happening? It is funny. It is interesting.
Like, I think there are probably a lot of these cords around.
Okay.
And there are probably a lot of broken joysticks that people have been like, well... The joystick's totally crashed, but I can, you know, use the cord or just lop off the cord and save it for later kind of thing.
Right.
Like, I don't think I don't have cords lying around like this, but I can imagine that I could or would. Right. I just don't happen to.
Yeah, and I would think, I mean, this would be a pretty hilarious conversation starter. Like, if somebody, it's, you know, again with, like, the Beagle Brothers bag.
Yeah.
You know, if you find someone who knows what it is, then you want to talk to that person.
That's right.
I have yet to find anybody comment on my weird flex of using that bag. In fact, I went grocery shopping today, used the bag. Uh-huh. It went uncommented.
Dang. Someday.
Someday. Oh, I'll be my new best friend.
All right. And so when you're done buying Atari joystick controller pendants, you can turn your credit cards to eBay and or whatever. Do whatever you want on eBay, but we have interesting things to tell you about, and Carrington has the first such interesting thing.
Some working, some untested. Those are the only options.
Right.
So the first thing is something I spotted that was very weird. It took me a while to work out what the heck's going on. So it's a Hot Wheels Apple, a custom Apple computer edition VW bus. So it's a little Hot Wheels car with the old Apple logo on it. It made no sense. So it's the photo that drew my eye. So you see a little Hot Wheels car in a package. So it's got like you would hang up on a wall. Weird thing is, package has the Apple computer logo, 6-color logo on top and big, but the logo is misprinted. Like the left side of the logo is cut off a bit. Uh-huh. Like it's I'm like, well, that's weird. And it's got the Apple computer without a registration mark on it in Apple Garamond. Then the bus itself has the old Apple logo, but the like older version with the font from Trapper Keeper, whatever that font is.
Right. Modern.
So like, well, that's an odd mix, and it's a numbered thing, number 000 out of 001, custom edition, 18 plus. I'm like, what is happening here? I don't understand this thing at all. And it's not that good looking, and it's $6.50. I don't get it. So reading the description finally explains to me, this is just somebody who's made this thing.
Yeah.
So it is a says this is a custom code 3 made car and card. Car are being repaint and take apart and put back in custom package. So I'm like, okay. Makes a lot more sense. So when I first saw this thing, I thought, oh, Hot Wheels made an Apple bus. No, they didn't. But if you're interested in this thing now that I've talked it up and made it sound so amazing and get it for $6.50, which isn't that bad for a little custom car, I think. So I don't think it's unreasonably priced. It's just the whole picture was confusing the heck out of me when I first saw it.
The thing, this and the bus being referred to here is like a, it's like a VW bus. It's like, you know, whatever, like the Mystery Machine or whatever.
Right. Oh yeah, that kind of bus, like a combi bus, not a bus, like a school bus.
Yeah.
It's all very weird. But I picked that after I'd picked my first thing, which is actually four things. So I wasn't sure what to pick, and I was browsing through the vintage computer stuff, and nothing was catching my eye. So another thing you can do sometimes, if you're just looking for stuff, you got money to burn, and you just want to buy some things on eBay, rather than search for a particular thing, sometimes I'll just combine a couple of terms, like combine a vintage brand with a year. And so I searched for Radio Shack in 1977. Came up with a bonanza of things that were interesting to look at. So all of these are on eBay at the moment from the glorious year of 1977. First is 1977 Vintage Radio Shack Introduces the World of Computing. It's a guide slash manual. I don't know if this was sold or just given, oh yeah, price $1. So something you must be able to walk into Radio Shacks in 1977 and said, what's all this computer stuff I've heard about? Is that going anywhere? Is that a fad? Radio Shack said, I'll tell you for $1. And so you could buy this little manual. I just found it interesting, and I'm hoping somebody either has it or buys it and scans it, because I'm hoping this kind of thing is saved. I have no idea how many pages it is. It looks like a brochure, but it's stapled, so it's got to be a bunch of pages. $18 to buy it now on eBay at the moment. Paul, do you have seven of these?
I have none of them. It is interesting, but you're right. It does. It looks like it's got to be like 12 pages a month, at least.
Yeah. So it's got to be something, and it was a dollar but in 1977, so it's got to be at least magazine size or something. So I imagine it was sitting on a counter. I don't know. Should you buy it? Should you not buy it? The way to know is with my next choice, the Radio Shack Executive Decision Maker. This kind of thing exists all over the place, and you can buy it cheaper. What's nice is this has 1970s, but it's actually the 1977 version, and it comes in the box. So if you want a Radio Shack Executive Decision Maker, then you can get this one in the original packaging, but it costs $40. These frequently seem to come up on eBay for like $10 if you don't want the box. So it's a $30 box and a $10 decision maker. And by decision maker, I mean it's essentially a magic eight ball, but in digital form. So it's a little cube and has, I guess you press a button to make a decision, and then it will light up an LED under one of, I think, six different, what can it give you? Definitely ask again, never, forget it, why not, and possibly. So perfect for executives.
You can make one of these that just every single time just said possibly.
Possibly. And it would always be true.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's your executive. His original sale price, it's got the sticker on it, $9.95. So it would have been a good investment for somebody. Change $10 into $40 if it sells.
Yeah.
Should have bought it back in the day. Should I have bought it back in the day? I didn't have an executive decision maker to tell me whether I should or not. Next up, 1977 Radio Shack catalog, exclusive to managers. So this is a big hardbound catalog from 1977 of the Radio Shack product guidelines. The person selling this actually has a bunch of these. I think they have the 76 through like 1989 or something. Each is a big hardbound thing. This has 56th anniversary, but every one has the whatever anniversary on it. This is catalog number 276, according to the manual. This really I found interesting. So it's a very large hardbound Radio Shack catalog. The supermarket of sound, it says on the back cover. I suspect I would have a lovely time browsing through this catalog from 1977. I bet there's a lot of Star Wars toys in there. I want them all. It would be fun.
I kind of remember looking through these at the time, you know, like not the big hardbound ones, but just, you know, I can see, like, you know, the photo on one page of like a stereo setup and, you know, a little, yeah, just a little description of that, and you can buy that, and, you know, I know I flipped through these as a kid.
Right.
Yep. It's so funny how I guess to paraphrase or to misquote Princess Bride, when I was a kid, the internet was called catalogs. And so nowadays, back then, as a kid, I used to like to browse through catalogs, but I think they'd fascinate me even more now. Like a Sears Christmas wish book or whatever from my childhood would probably be a very fascinating thing to me as an adult. Anyway, I thought this was a cool looking catalog, and I liked the fact that it was hardbound. And then the last thing I found, and this is another thing that exists in like 100 versions. This one struck me as kind of neat because it's got a box, even though it's in terrible shape, but it's the 1977 one. And that was the whole point. 1977 Bonanza. This is the electronic TV scoreboard, which is Radio Shack's branded Pong game. There's a bunch of these that exist. I think I could have probably picked 25 different versions of the electronic TV scoreboard. It's amazing how many versions this went through. But it's your traditional Pong game. This is the one that came in two parts, a right-hand controller and a left-hand controller. The earlier versions of this was just like a single box. This is also a late enough version that has the spinning wheel. So like most of us think of Pong games, you'll have a dial. And so you dial back and forth to move the things up and down. And that's what this one is, except it weirdly has blue dials. Every time I've seen this kind of thing before, it comes with like brown stuff, because everything from the 1970s was earth tones. So I don't know what's up with this blue. Must have gotten painted. Totally like modern collector painted it up. So this is just a Pong game with a big, tall controller for the person on the right who gets all the buttons and sets all the settings, and a little tiny controller for the person on the left. Earlier versions of this, it'd be kind of neat to look at the trajectory of Pong controller changes, because this is what I think of as a Pong controller, dials to move the thing up and down. But I guess that was probably seen as confusing originally for home ones. A lot of like older versions of this and older Pong games sometimes came with like more like looks like a light switch or a slider dial. Mm-hmm. And so you would slide it up and down to slide your paddle up and down on the monitor. So I guess it was more of a correspondence versus the dial. The dial is way easier to work with, probably easier to build as well. So this is that. So it comes in a box. The box is beat up like crazy, and it's $30, and it's Pong game. Can't go wrong with Pong for $30. Buy it. The executive decision maker says, buy it now. That is my 1977 Radio Shack Bonanza.
Awesome.
I went full Pong.
I want to say extra points for the seller of this Pong game, because they actually hooked up to a brand new modern TV and took screenshots of it. Like, they took photos of their Vizio TV screen running the old Pong game.
And one of them, you can see their hands held up in the reflection, yeah, like holding their phone or whatever.
Yep.
But yes, and it shows that it's working.
Cool.
And super staticky image on the screen. Yes. But, yep.
Much static.
Cool.
Very cool.
I love Pong. I think I love the idea of Pong. I suspect I'd get bored of Pong actually playing it, but I think it's one of the best ever. Just the idea of Pong really appeals to me.
You know, one of the things they do have at the retro gathering that I will go to again this year, very likely, is to have the Swedish masters in Pong.
Ooh.
And last year, I played, I didn't win. I won something else. They had some trivia game that I won. I did okay at Pong, but not great.
What's Pong called in Swedish? Or is it just Pong with an umlaut over the O?
No, it's just the same. It's just Pong. Oh, although I guess, yeah, they probably don't say Pong right now. They probably say Pong.
Huh. Pong.
It's going to be spela Pong.
Love it.
Excellent.
So Paul, did you go full Paul?
I have. Well, okay. So, I have actually a couple of things that are left over from the, you know, an earlier time when we were going to record. And so not all of the things that I have here are in fact even still for sale on eBay, but I think they were kind of interesting, so I'll talk about them. The first thing, though, is still for sale, so I'll just mention it. This is a Commodore calculator, model 899A. So I'm sure we have talked about these before, but Commodore did not start out making computers. They started out making, I don't know what, business machines, I think, you know, but so this is, you know, this is whatever, it's a Commodore branded calculator. It says Commodore on it. It doesn't actually have the that little, it has the Chicken Lips logo on the back. It doesn't seem to have it on the front. But one thing I liked about this particular one is that it actually also comes with a box. You know, that's relatively rare to see, and the box is not in great shape, but it is still the box for it. So if you're looking for one of these, and it does seem to work, it's been tested and at least can show a zero. The manual seems to have been eaten by a mouse or something, so it has some holes in it. So actually, this looked better to me before than when I'm looking at it right now, because it's the first bid is $60. So I don't know. It's interesting to look at the box. Maybe I'll just leave it at that. Do either of you have Commodore calculators? Probably not.
I don't.
You do not.
I do. I like the look of it. I like the light up LED calculators from the 70s before they figured out that draws way more power than we need to draw. But I like that, and I also really like the way these buttons look, because it reminds me of the way old calculators looked and felt.
Yeah. And there's a reason.
Because it's an old calculator.
Looking at this picture makes me want to press some buttons.
True. Yeah. So. Yeah, it is pretty pleasing. If you don't care about the beat-up box and the mouse-eaten instructions, then you can get them more cheaply than this. And there are a number of models. But this one thing that we do know is that this works. I think I have one that has like green LEDs. I think I've seen it go, but I don't have the box for it. It's kind of neat to have like one random Commodore calculator, so you can say to your friends who didn't know that Commodore made calculators, but did somehow know that they made computers, that you have one. So let's see. The next one was sold some time ago, a couple weeks ago maybe. It's listed as sole terminal computer with disk drive, disks monitor. And if you look at it, it actually was a really nice set. So it's kind of neat to see. It appears when you look at it, it is, it looks like a Sol 20. It has two disk drives, which I almost never see. And like a little security monitor, some cables and stuff, and a couple of disks. I thought it was sort of interesting that they didn't call it a Sol 20. It's a Sol terminal computer, and that's what it says on the front. I mean, you can see, so I can see why they would say that. But in fact, actually, if you look at the photos and sort of look at the badge in the back, it doesn't say Sol 20. It says Sol terminal computer model number 10. Which makes it seem like this is a Sol 10. Except my understanding of what a Sol 10 is doesn't look like this. So I thought a Sol 10 did not have as many expansion slots as this seems to. So it looks to me like, from all appearances except that badge, like a Sol 20. But I thought it was interesting to sort of point out, because I didn't even really know that there was a Sol 10 before seeing this and kind of trying to sort of dig around in the history. But also seeing the disk drives is cool, because I'm not convinced I've seen them before.
Me neither.
I really like the, whatever number this is, Sol whatever. I love this computer. It's very beautiful. It's got wooden sides, and it's blue. And the blue
is gorgeous, yeah. And I completely agree. I think it's one of the most beautiful retro computers. I adore them. I mean, I don't like want to use an S100 computer, but I think it's gorgeous to look at.
Yeah. And the keys on the keyboard are not all the same color. I see at least three different colors, like intentionally three different colors. Anyway, so if you wanted to see, I'd be curious to know if anyone listening to this can understand why that badge says Sol 10, and yet this seems to be more expandable than I thought Sol 10s were supposed to be. I'd be interested to hear that too. Okay, what's the next thing I have? Slow to load. Oh yeah, this is one that Ian pointed out to us, actually, on Twitter, I think. But I think it says it ended by the seller because there was an error in the listing, which means I think somebody offered something and it was accepted. It's an Osborne 1 computer, so we know it's the sort of like, sewing machine type, thing. And the Osborne 1 is sort of comical for having, I don't even know how big this is. It's like a 3-inch screen or something. It's like some little tiny, tiny, tiny
screen. At most, it is so small.
Yeah, but the thing that's cool about this particular auction is it has with it an Osborne external monitor, which I don't think I've ever, I may have seen a black and white rendition of it in a newsletter or something like that. I'm not sure that I've never seen it.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
Yeah, it's Osborne branded. It plugs in somehow. It's not. It looks like it has some kind of ribbon cable, so it's not even like just a, it's not composite. It is composite, whatever it is. It's not a regular plug. So it'd be cool to see this thing. It's very yellow, but I guess it sort of matches the computer itself. Anyway, it's interesting to see because you may not have known that it existed like I didn't.
I did not.
Let's see. This is the next one for sale. Oh, this is for sale, but it's less cool. So I don't know why I picked this, but anyway, this is just like some dumb thing from, you know, probably the 90s. It is essentially a mouse pad, but it's supposed to be shaped like a surfboard because you're surfing the nets. So.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So it is a net board for hard surfing.
I think you have to read what it says.
And it says, unlock your mind. Yeah. Amazing. Amazing.
So anyway, yeah. If you were looking for, if you're collecting really goofy mouse pads, this is one such thing.
Sure is.
The starting bid is $1. So, and that's what you want to do. For some reason, this...
Got to buy it now.
Yeah, the auction is set up such that you can either bid $1 or you can buy it now for $1,000, which I think means...
They have high hopes.
Yeah. I mean, I assume that this just means they just want you to bid. Don't mess around. Yeah, I don't know why anyone would do that. Because it seems inconceivable that somebody would actually buy this for that much.
Could be a mistake that they meant to do the buy it now for $9.99. And they'll be surprised as heck when somebody buys it for $1,000.
Could be.
Though I would have thought that would have come out as $9.99 rather than $9.99.99.
Oh. They just kept hitting nines.
Yeah.
Unlock your nines.
Okay. Anyway, I thought that was interesting. Boy, I still seem to have two. Okay. Well, I'll keep going. I thought this is kind of an interesting thing. It's Spectrum Sinclair, Timex Sinclair emulator. And what it actually is, it doesn't actually say this in the title, but it's for the Timex Sinclair 2068, and which is kind of like a U.S. color Timex Sinclair computer, but it is not actually compatible with the Spectrum unless you have this cartridge. So this cartridge is basically, you know, it gives you the ROM, basically, as far as I understand it, so that you can use your TS-2068 as a Spectrum. And that's pretty cool.
It's weird looking, though. Was this a developer thing or a homebrew? It's unbranded.
Yeah.
It has two chips and a resistor.
Yeah, I think this is... it looks terrible. but I think that's partly just because that's the way... I think it is semi-homebrew. I mean, I don't think it was produced by a company. But it's not a one-off either. I mean,
maybe it's a Sinclair thing. They're like, yeah, if you want it good looking, what about an Apple? Take it.
Actually, if you click on the rightmost picture and zoom in, near the bottom of the thing, near the pins, it says upside down, made in someplace.
Yeah. Enhance.
Enhance. Exactly. Enhance.
The light is a little too dim.
So it looks like it's like someone has marked this case as being, you know, something made in some country or whatever.
Yeah.
But then, boy, they didn't take time to make it look good.
Well, my guess actually is that this is a repurposed case for like a, you know, like they took a common one and stuck different ROMs in it. You can get, so I have a kit for making a new one of these. At some point, I intend to sort of put it together so that I can do this. But I think the ROM itself, the emulator ROM itself, is not part of what I have. So I still need to figure out a way to create that thing. And so that's one thing that this has, it has the ROM in it. But otherwise, that's about as complicated as it is. But it's interesting that it exists. It's possible that if you have a 2068, you already knew it exists. But I didn't immediately know that this existed. It's because otherwise, actually, the Timex Sinclair 2068, it's a nice color computer. It does a lot of the same kind of stuff as the Spectrum, but it's incompatible with everything. So, there's just not that much you can do with a 2068 as a 2068. All right. I must have been looking at Sinclair stuff. I'm not sure how I got both of these to come up. But the last one, I thought this was just kind of funny. Maybe everybody knows that this existed, but I hadn't known it. It's... the ZX Spectrum Plus 2 James Bond 007 Action Pack, which is a form in which you can buy a ZX Spectrum.
Cool.
Yeah, have you guys had a look at this? It's actually like...
No.
you know, actually, Atari used to have something sort of like this, like the Educator or something like that. Or, you know, like, there were certain like packagings you could get the Atari computer with a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
This one comes with a James Bond game and like a Sinclair light gun stuff.
I wonder if the game's any good.
I wonder.
Don't know.
It's just such a weird thing. I mean, like, I'm totally out of the Sinclair world, so I don't know. I don't know if everybody knows about this, but I certainly hadn't really seen this before. And I've been kind of looking for a Sinclair, you know, ZX Spectrum. So it's a little bit tempting.
But... And the game comes with some, like, pack-in stuff, like a James Bond passport and a letter, an internal memo to 007. A handwritten note by Moneypenny. So cool that they have all the bits and pieces.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm very drawn to things that are complete like this, you know, or mostly complete, because so often the stuff that has survived, you know, by itself in a different box from the box where everything else was, you know.
Right.
This actually did seem to stay together, and, you know, the box is in reasonable-ish shape. I mean, it's pretty beat up, but it's, you know, it's the picture's still intact and stuff. Carrington, I don't suppose you know the game at all, right?
I do not. I dig it.
Yeah.
Action pack. I resist anything that says action pack.
And comes with a little, like, light beam gun.
Exactly. So. Which wouldn't work on any modern television, but whatever.
Oh, need to work. No, it's James Bond. How would that work? I don't even know how they, I mean, like, I don't know how they worked before, but presumably it had something to do with, like, watching what was going on the scan lines.
Yeah, it was like a screen blank or whatever.
Yeah.
So they only work on an old CRT.
Boo. I disapprove. <You're>
like, flash everything bright. James Bond says no.
Anyway, cool. All right, I've made it through my list of even more miscellaneous things than usual. And so we can go to closing discussions. Carrington, you have a link here, so alphabetically we'll start stupidities.
Yeah, computer stupidities. So this is, if you've been around, if you're like a million years old like me, then, and you've been on the internet forever, then you probably pronounce GIF the same way that I do. And also, you'll remember SIGs on everything on Usenet and all. And also stupid computer stories, which mostly were about, aren't we cool computer people so smart and everybody else is so dumb? I fixed the printer and here's what I had. Anyway, this is a collection of super vintage. I mean, I think the site itself hasn't been updated for 10 years now, but it's computer stupidities. So it's little SIGs and little stories of, like, customer says this, tech support says this, customer does a silly thing, tech support solves it in a really cool way, tech support is awesome. Oh, it's like cringeworthy, but I can't look away. It's amazing. So, oh yeah, latest editions 1/21/13. So 2013, they were still adding stuff. Some things are new. Some things are new. Some things are new. Excitingly, like, very excitingly.
Oh yeah, you're right.
It's awesome. It's great. So if you want to see stuff from the early days of the web and modems and calls from hell and all the kind of programming jargon jokes and things, it's a good collection of those. Super vintage. Right up my alley. Yeah. I cringe. I read. I'm a better person.
So this is awesome. Like a much expanded version of, like, you know, the complaints about the cup holders and stuff.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Nice.
But it's in categories. Like, when you go in the front and click on amnesia, you think it's a story about amnesia. Oh, no. Here's 35 jokes all about, like, computer amnesia or whatever. One-liners and a bunch of things. And anyway, it's, if you see it, if you know these kind of things, you'll totally recognize it. And I haven't seen a collection this large in quite a while. So totally worth seeing. So
all right.
I have that link.
Cool.
From me to all of you.
Awesome.
That also could have been an item of interest or news, but that's okay. And any further things you wanted to say about your closing shots or whatever?
I've done nothing but read the site.
All right.
All I do is read the site and keep off Facebook.
Yeah.
You're trying to change me, man.
Jack, do you have any sort of parting shot?
I've been failing at bidding on a number of auctions, which has kind of been sad. I'm not really looking at eBay much. I'm mostly looking at a local Swedish thing called Tradera, which now and then I see some Atari stuff. And just today I lost a couple of bids on some Atari cartridges that I was going to go in late and, like, snipe and get the thing, and, like, somebody counter sniped me and got it. But, you know, they ended up spending way more money than I would have wanted to, so that was fine. But one thing that bummed me out was a few weeks ago there was an ATR 8000, and this is one of the kind of rare pieces of Atari hardware. It's made by a third-party company, SWP. And basically, this is an external box to let you do a bunch of things. It had standard serial and parallel interfaces, so you could easily plug in a modem and a printer. And it had a bunch of RAM, so it could be a print spooler. And it could run CPM. And some of them had a coprocessor that was an 8088 and could run some IBM PC type stuff.
Holy moly, that's quite the magic box.
It was a magic box. And it had industry standard floppy drive interfaces. You could plug in 5 1/4 or 8-inch drives from whatever other sources that were like not Atari-specific drives and use those. So,
but this isn't a story about you getting
this. No, this is a story about me seeing this on Tradera. And like, it's rare enough to see any Atari 8-bit stuff on there at all, let alone this. And I was like, awesome, this is so great. And then somehow I just like missed it. Like the time went by and I was like, I think I had set myself a reminder in my calendar, but did not put an alarm on it. And so 2 hours later, I was like, oh crap. And I looked and it's like, yeah, of course it was gone. And like the price it went for, I would have definitely paid. So it was super frustrating.
Yeah.
But oh well. So that's what I've been doing in retro computing land, is failing to buy things that I wanted to buy.
But you're trying, I suppose.
I'm trying.
Stefan. I don't know if it's the right direction. It is a step in a direction.
It's a step.
You're joining me in minimalism, but just through failure. Yes. Hey, that's probably how I ended up here, too.
Yeah, I have. So on eBay, I actually do tend to use a like automatic sniping thing. I used to think that was not sportsmanlike, but then I later decided that has nothing to do with anything. Yeah, the one I use, it's actually kind of nice. I can reveal it to the you know, listening public or whatever, but it's Gixxon.com. I've had pretty good luck with that. And it's not even, like, it is free, but there's a paid tier that will give you a sort of like a backup. So in case it sort of snipes from two locations and really seriously at the last second. So that has worked pretty well. I've often tended to just sort of set that up and let it go rather than tip people off to the fact that I'm interested in this thing by bidding early.
Hmm. Whenever I bid, I was super old fashioned. I would just pick the amount I'd be willing to spend, bid that right away. And then maybe I get it. Maybe I don't. If I get it, then I'm happy with what I spent. If I don't, it means it went for more than I wanted.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's actually the kind of advantage of the sniping things too. You can do that same thing, but there's sort of less chance that it'll get, like, someone will notice it and say, oh yeah, that is interesting, I will also bid.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway.
I guess, I don't know, if I'm interested in a thing and there's a bid already, that'll shy me away more than it'll make me keen to go at getting a bidding war.
Yeah.
I see a thing I really like and there's no bids on it, I'm more likely to say, hey, maybe I can get this cheap. If I get there and there is a bid, I'm like, I don't want to, yeah, whatever, I take it.
Yeah. And I've gotten, even though they do sort of obscure the eBay IDs, I don't know why they don't actually obscure them. Instead, they tend to put like a letter, 3 stars, and another letter, and then show their number of feedback. So it is actually quite easy to figure out who, you know, particularly if you're bidding against the same people all the time, it's constant. So like you can say, oh, okay, you know, I recognize this person. And you can verify that it's that person by going and looking them up and seeing that the feedback number is the same.
Right.
So it's anyway. So the point of that was just, there are certain people that if I see them bidding, I know I'm not going to, you know, I don't even need to bother with this. I'm not going to get there. This person will bid way more than I could. But anyway, what am I doing? I'm not bidding on much. I work in academia and the school year is about to start, and that has really kind of like conked me out. So that's almost everything I've been doing has been more about that than any sort of retro computing. And it's frustrating because my office is a kind of a mess, and I would like to be able to meet people in my office, you know, use it as an office. But the summer is going to get away from me here. So anyway. That's what I'm, you know, what's going on with me is I need more time, like everybody.
Like everybody.
But I'm not unhappy. I can at least say that. All right, any other things to say before we wind this down and I go edit both this and the previous one?
I think so.
Nope.
All right. Then that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group, at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at a link that is in the show notes. Please write a review on iTunes or not. And
no, do it. It's super helpful.
Yeah. Yes, right. And until next time,
Retro Compute.